For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Everyone was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
What an outrage. Well, I'm very surprised. It flies in the face of the US being an immigrant nation, doesn't it?
Data on crimes committed by migrants in Australia will be tracked by the United States following a directive from the Trump administration. You'll hear more than just those initial thoughts from a group representing ethnic communities and migrants. Then, an out-of-the-box solution for aged care. The university, now run by former politician Bill Shorten, will develop a large-scale aged care community on campus.
For the people living here, they'll be living on a university campus, which is, I think, a great intergenerational experience for everyone.
And then the clock is ticking on a key government deadline.
I do share that sense of urgency. I think we've got as close as we're going to get to a compromise deal.
The government has just two sitting days remaining to meet its deadline to pass its environmental laws. We'll hear from a key lobby group weighing in on the debate. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. So the Trump administration has told the US Embassy in Canberra to gather data on crimes being committed by migrants in Australia. The ABC has confirmed the US Embassy in Canberra has been given the directive, along with embassies in several other Western nations, including New Zealand and Canada. Now, there are plenty of questions. Why does the US care? What does it mean for Canberra? And what does it mean for the migrant communities being monitored by Washington? Farah Farouk runs the Ethnic Communities Council of Victoria, and Sally had quite a bit to get through with her today.
Farah Farouk is the CEO of the Ethnic Communities Council of Victoria, the peak body for ethnic and multicultural organisations in the state.
What an outrage.
Well, you've got ahead of me. I was going to ask, what do you make of this directive from the US to its embassies?
Well, I'm very surprised. It flies in the face of the US being an immigrant nation, doesn't it? Those of us who've seen, you know, Lady Liberty welcoming immigrants historically, the Statue of Liberty, to America, this is just ridiculous. It's an old trope, the idea that immigrants are responsible progenitors of crime. Last time I looked, immigrants built America and immigrants have helped build Australia equally.
Should the United States be allowed to gather data on migrants in Australia?
Well, I don't know how they propose to do so. I presume they'll get it from public sources, and I don't think there are very reliable or authoritative studies that support that proposition. This is an old right-wing proposition that immigrants are to blame for all of society's ills. It just doesn't wash. It does not actually fit the data sets that are available, and I'm not sure what they will find. They'll have to make up some magic pudding.
Should the federal government push back or make its displeasure known, in your view?
So I would urge Australia's politicians and public officials to contest this kind of narrative. These are hateful narratives built to distract from serious issues, and they absolutely have no merit. There is no such, even the American Immigration Council, I had a little check of their data, and they've done a comprehensive comparison of crime data from 1980 to 2020. And in fact, even though the number of immigrants to the US increased, there was a drop in the crime rate. And there is no authoritative data to support any such proposition here in Australia.
If this, as you're saying, is likely to be drawn from publicly available data, and if, as you're saying, the story of the contribution of migrants to Australia is positive, what's the problem? Why not let them go their hardest?
people are entitled to do what they wish, but I think driving false narratives, we all know disinformation and misinformation is causing a lot of anxiety. We've seen anti-immigrant rallies spill onto our streets from social media. So I think it is very important that we have fact-based discussions about important issues. And organisations like the Ethnic Communities Council of Victoria say, bring it on, let's talk about migration levels, let's have fact-based discussions. But distracting with false narratives is about supposed a contribution, or if that's the word, to the crime rate, is of no merit whatsoever.
If they're looking for the data, is that a false narrative? If they're just asking for data, going to look for data?
Oh, well, I mean, is it the data by tabloid headlines? Is that the data they'll be counting? I'm not sure, Sally.
Pauline Hanson has made international headlines this week for again wearing a burqa in the Senate. What's your reaction to what took place?
Oh, well, look, Pauline has been distracting us for decades, hasn't she? I mean, she was on a dancing show on television, and equally she's dancing false narratives and dress-ups in Parliament.
When you look at what might be happening in the wider community, we know that polling has shown a significant increase in popularity for One Nation since the election. Sometimes we've seen patterns where that kind of support can soften when people actually go to the ballot box. But what do you make of this seeming increase in support for the agenda and the policies of One Nation?
Well, as I recall, during the election period, there was an attempt to bring up issues around migration, and they were resoundingly knocked back by the Australian population. I think the finding of the election and the outcome of the election showed that people didn't buy into that kind of discussion. Yes, subsequently, there has been some increase in Pauline's numbers, but she inhabits, she's a minority party and inhabits a small part of the Australian polity. She might share Mr. Trump's hair colour, but I don't think she's about to take on the lodge.
Farah Farouk, the CEO of the Ethnic Communities Council of Victoria. Well, let's stay with federal politics and Pauline Hanson with Melissa Clark, our federal political correspondent. She'll get us up to date with the response from Parliament to her latest burqa stunt, and also give us a bit of detail on this deadline facing the government to pass its environmental laws.
There's certainly been a lot of focus on Pauline Hanson's actions in the Senate. And what we saw yesterday was the formal ramifications for that. She has been suspended for 7 sitting days. So that was as passed by the Senate. So that's a serious rebuke. To be suspended for that long from the Parliament is very unusual and gives us a sense of the severity with which the Senate views her actions in wearing the burqa in a way that would be offensive to many Muslim Australians. I think it's also interesting to note that Susan Lee, as opposition leader, has been quite strong in condemning One Nation for the approach on this. It's not often we get a strong attack on One Nation from the coalition. There's often a reluctance or a concern that it might alienate voters who might have sympathies for One Nation's agenda. But with polling support rising for One Nation, we're seeing a shift from the coalition looking to attack Pauline Hanson, and her actions in trying to get some attention on this issue has given Susan Lee an opportunity to take on One Nation head on rather than trying to hedge around in a policy sense. So it's been interesting to watch it unfold, both in terms of the consequences for Pauline Hanson, but also how the coalition have responded to this with an eye to electoral politics.
The government's only got a couple of days to try and push through its reforms to environmental laws. What's the latest on the negotiations? The clock is ticking.
It certainly is. They need to get a deal today, really, in order to have tomorrow to pass it through the Senate. Now, the government has put forward amendments to both the Coalition and the Greens, different sets of amendments for the different offers to see which one might succeed. in both cases, they're really forcing the government to do the work of offering up the detail rather than the Greens and the Coalition coming back with their own alternative. So they're both putting the pressure on the government to deliver up something they're happy with. This could go down to the wire. Lower House MPs have been told to stay in Canberra on Friday in case they do manage to change it on Thursday, and it's got to be then rubber stamped again by the lower house. So it could go down to the wire, but there's a lot of optimistic talk amongst government ranks. So we'll see.
Mel Clark there. So given how tense the situation is, there is definitely still lobbying going on all sides. The gas industry wants concessions and environmental groups want protections. It doesn't think what's on offer meets the necessary standard. But there are some on the business side who just want a deal to be struck, to give them a bit of certainty. One of the groups is the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies, and its CEO, Warren Pearce, came on with Sally this morning.
Both the Coalition and the Greens say they're happy to negotiate over these environment laws into the new year, but the Minister, Murray Watt, is determined to see them through Parliament this week. Do you share his sense of urgency, or would it be better to take some time in the view of the Greens and the Coalition and get it right?
Look, I do share that sense of urgency. I think we've got as close as we're going to get to a compromise deal. The reality is we've been working on this now for over 5 years since the Graham Samuel report was commissioned by Susan Lee and then legislation brought to the Parliament for the first time. We've had two attempts already. We've been at this for 5 years. We've got the conservation movement, industry proponents and peak bodies to the table. We've got as far as we're going to get on what we agree on. We now need the parliamentarians to step in to find the best possible compromise and work out a balanced deal.
The Coalition and the Greens have raised a variety of concerns, but you've said there's only one real deal breaker. What is that in your view?
Well, there's only one real deal breaker from industry in our perspective. That's the unacceptable impacts provision. So at the moment, that threshold is far too low. If you apply the way it's written into the legislation now, you'd be stopping projects in the resources sector all over the country and indeed in other industries too, like the property sector or the agricultural sector. So we've got to get that component fixed, that threshold lifted a bit higher. So when unacceptable impacts are considered, that, you know, that does recognise that there are some things that are unacceptable impacts, and that should be rare, but not the rule. And that's where we've got to get that change. Everything else, there's room for compromise. There's already been a commitment around the Commonwealth reaching bilateral agreements with the states and territories. That's the win for industry. Potentially that could pull 12 months out of the approvals process for major projects. So indeed, there's room to compromise on some of the other issues.
Yesterday, the minister said that he's, quote, open to making some amendments to the definition of unacceptable impacts, but that it can't be degraded so much that it ends up being meaningless, in his words. Is that encouraging to industry?
Look, I think that's fair. I mean, I think we've got to recognise, actually, that there are some things that we shouldn't, places we shouldn't be building projects, and there are some impacts on the environment and biodiversity that we shouldn't accept. So that's a reasonable thing to put into legislation. Indeed, that hasn't been there in the past, and that's one of the reasons we need more contemporary environmental legislation. So industry's recognising there needs to be change. We're signing up for stronger protections, but we need to get a balanced outcome now. We're as close as we're going to get in terms of where the various sides of this debate are at, and there's still momentum to actually get this done now. I think I'm concerned, and indeed the industry is concerned, if we go back to the table over the next 8 or 12 weeks into next year, parties will retreat to their corners, and it'll be very difficult to come back to even where we're at now.
So your message is get it done.
Absolutely. Our message to parliamentarians is, look, recognise there are a couple of things that absolutely have to happen, both from the perspective of the industry and the conservation movement. The rest, there's room to make a deal. We've gone as far as we're going to get to. We need our parliamentarians to step in and finish the job.
What's your message to the Coalition in particular? Because that's a different view from the Coalition's position right now, which is they'll meet with the government every week for the next 8 or 12 weeks to get it done rather than 2 days.
What our message to the Coalition is come to the table. We need the parties of government to get together on this, with Labor, Liberal and Nationals to play a leading role and to actually land some balanced reform here. I think our concern, obviously, if the Labor sides have to deal with the Greens or has to deal with the Greens, then obviously that balanced outcome could be under threat.
What do you believe will be the cost if this reform fails to become law this time?
Well, first of all, we'll end up with a situation that's basically a lose-lose. We don't have contemporary environmental protections in Australia. In a sense, we're still working under a policy that basically tries to offset environmental impact, looking for like-for-like offsets, rather than moving to a more contemporary legislation that seeks actually not just to offset the impact, but actually to add some environmental improvements to leave the environment a better place than we found it. From an industry perspective, the reality of me working through a system we know has major duplication between the state and federal processes comes at a significant cost and time loss for industry. We're really going to be stuck in the same situation we've been in now for the last 10 or 15 years, where everyone's been demanding change but can't get any.
And you were just listening to the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies CEO, Warren Pearce, speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Well, let's quickly head overseas, because we woke up to a glimmer of good news this morning that all 24 schoolgirls who were abducted by armed assailants in Nigeria last week had been rescued. Now, there are no details released about the rescue mission, but this follows a series of violent attacks across Nigeria, including the abduction of more than 300 students from a Catholic school in Niger State. Medina Meshanu is a BBC reporter on the ground in Niger State, and she shared this update with Sally.
About 303 students and 12 teachers were kidnapped on Friday. But about 50 have said to escaped between Friday and now, according to the school. But even the school proprietor has said to me that they did not really see these children themselves. They were only getting calls from their parents. And I also had an interview with the police commissioner of Niger State, and he was very skeptical about the number of the students that have said to escape from the unknown gunmen then and gone back home. So there's still a lot of confusion.
How much anger is there from parents?
The parents are really angry. It's a gloomy mood of hopelessness. They said to me they feel like they have been abandoned by the government, and they feel like they are not part of the state, because even before they have been facing insecurity around that area. Northern part of Niger State has been a hotspot or a hotbed for abductions for ransom in recent times. But they said nothing has been done. So due to that, the parents are very angry. They feel they have been left behind. No one is coming to help them. The community also cannot come together and do anything. So they feel helpless at the moment. It's quite a sad sight.
Medina, what do we know about the motivations behind this kidnapping? Who might have carried it out, and whether it's a case of ransom or there are political or other motivations? What do we know?
So no one has claimed to have taken these children yet, and no ransom has been demanded. In fact, they have not reached out to any party yet. And regarding the reason, kidnappings and attacks like this are not a new thing in Nigeria. About a decade ago, we had the Chibok girls kidnap, which to date, some girls are still with their captors. So it's not a new thing, but in recent times, since a statement by the US President Donald Trump, he designated Nigeria as a country of particular concern. So since that time, there has been, increase in abductions and cases like this.
Well, speaking to us from Niger State was Medina Meshanu, a BBC reporter on the ground in Nigeria. It's been a while since we've heard from former Labour leader Bill Shorten, but now as the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Canberra, there are still some nationally relevant issues on his plate. And he came on today to discuss a rather interesting solution to one of them. As Australia grapples with an ageing population, aged care remains a real sticking point in government funding arrangements. So, one out-of-the-box solution, the University of Canberra has announced it will develop a large-scale aged care community next to the University of Canberra Hospital. It's part of a 100-year agreement designed to bring residents closer to where their healthcare staff are actually trained. We invited Bill Shorten on this morning, and he explained just how the idea would work.
Well, this is a proposal which the universities had discussions on, but we've turbocharged them this year, and we were announcing yesterday. It's 180 residential care beds and 230 dependent living units. At the heart of this is collaboration. We at the University of Canberra teach a lot of allied health professionals. We teach nurses. We've got a research centre specifically about aging. So We thought we'd use the land of the campus productively. We've got a training hospital, which is great for local people. And by putting in the aged care facility, we can use our land productively. It'll generate jobs in construction and ongoing operation jobs. But best of all, it means that our workforce, when they're studying, will be able to do integrated work learning at the same time as doing their sort of bookwork. And this just means better skilled graduates when they finish. So it's got multiple dimensions. And of course, you know, to wrap it all together, for the people living here, they'll be living on a university campus, which is, I think, a great intergenerational experience for everyone.
We know that most Australians who need support when they age are in their own homes rather than in residential care. Mm. What about the reverse thinking, and that is, rather than bringing older Australians to the campus, should the campus be going more out to the community?
Oh, listen, there's no doubt, you're 100% right, that people being able to grow old in their own homes is the preferred option. I don't think this is going to replace that. But I think that when you look at the independent living propositions here, it does give the ability for people to downsize those 3- and 4-bedroom houses, which helps with housing affordability more generally, which is an issue in Canberra suburbs like everywhere else in Australia. So that's good. We'll also be, through our training, I mean that we'll be able to deliver more qualified graduates who can do home care. And we'll also be doing outreach from both the research we do at the university, but also there'll be home services available within this complex.
How important do you think it is for health professionals, even if they're not going to specialise in that area, to be literate or aware in the needs of ageing Australians?
It's crucial. Listen, you know, as you observed, I've been in politics for 18 years and I've been the Vice Chancellor for 10 months. But one of the great things about the University of Canberra, which attracted me to apply for the job here, is that they're a vocational university. So it's a big part of the educational philosophy at UC. It's not exclusive to University of Canberra, but it's certainly a hallmark of UC, is that work integrated learning. If in each year that a student's doing a course here for a professional vocation, they can do training on the tools, it helps immensely with their employability, with the breadth of their experience. And I think it's better for their learning if some points during each year and semester they're out there in the real world. And it helps the penny drop about, oh, that's why we're studying this. And our aged care research units here at UC are world-class too. So we're doing a lot of aged care research about the best techniques.
We've had some comments from economist Chris Richardson urging the government to take more action on reforms, particularly given the size of its majority that it won in the last election. Is this a time for a Labor government to be ambitious in reform, in your view?
Well, some things don't change, and Chris Richardson's still giving advice to the government, for which I'm sure they're grateful. I think they are doing a range of things. It's not my job to be a salesperson for the government, but in the university context, with what Jason Clare's doing, they're being pretty ambitious. We've got to have the overdue discussion about reforming the Jobs Ready graduate program, the unloved policy child of the Morrison era. But they're reducing HEX debt. They're also moving to needs-based funding and managed growth in universities.
But what about big tax reform?
Oh, well, people had a chance for some big tax reform in 2019 and didn't. And 49% of people wanted it. No, I'm not going to give advice to the government on what they need to do there. There's no doubt in my mind that income is taxed too heavily in Australia and property is taxed too lightly. But, you know, I've hung up my legislative spurs and now trying to help create a modern, contemporary, relevant university.
And you were just listening to University of Canberra Vice Chancellor Bill Shorten. Thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josie Scott. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and we'll see you tomorrow for another day of The Breakfast Wrap.